dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people that we have had grace this program over, well, some 10 years now of weeknightly broadcasts who have brought more intelligence to the various topics that they discuss with me, have done so with more clarity of thought, and I believe with more accuracy than our guest for this full hour. And that means you're in for a treat. Mark Helprin is a man I've come to admire greatly, both for his extraordinary essays, one of which has been published just today in the Wall Street Journal, as well as for his myriad books, both fiction and nonfiction, including most recently, Paris in the Present Tense. Some of them have been made into movies. Some of them are just highly acclaimed in its literature of the first order. All of them are extraordinary reads, and his speaking ain't too shabby either, and we're going to indulge in a fair amount of that. Let me just say, he is these days a senior fellow with the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy. He is also, somewhat inexplicably, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Mark Helprin, good to have you. Thanks for joining us and giving us a full hour of your time.
Well, thanks, Frank. It's always great to be here.
Let's start, Mark, with the essay that you had in the Wall Street Journal today. It talks about a subject that is scarcely ever mentioned in polite company, even among people who are now increasingly, and I think properly, worried about what communist China is up to. And that is what it is doing specifically in regards to building up quite prodigious strategic theater and tactical nuclear forces with which to threaten neighbors and others, including us, and quite possibly, perhaps, to use them with devastating effect. Tell us about your essay and what your principal recommendation is in it.
Okay, well, first of all, everyone's attention has been drawn toward cyber war, and as it rightly should be. People are worried about the denial of U.S. military capabilities via things that would shut down and hack and blind us, but and not worried enough about EMP, which is the ultimate cyber war weapon.
That would be electromagnetic pulse, of course.
That's one thing, and I think the attention should be focused on that, certainly. But you can't ignore nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons have somehow been shunted to the side as if they no longer matter, and that's perhaps because we haven't had a hostile nuclear detonation since 1945. But they're there, and they can be used not only in terms of actually using them, but using them to both deter in a friendly manner or to lay out areas in which an opponent can't go, or to blackmail, or to even win by maneuver and actually conquer countries just because you happen to have the nuclear weapons. Now, I just want to start off by saying that quite a while ago, when Mike Pence was governor, I was at his governor's mansion, and I had to give a speech. It was an impromptu speech, and I didn't know what I was going to have to do, but I was called upon to do it. And I got up and I gave a speech, and I started off with a description of the three-body problem in physics and mathematics. And I began to lose the audience, because who the hell cares about the three-body problem in physics and mathematics? But then I gained the audience, because this is why. The three-body problem says that if you have three bodies, let's say like three planets, or even three atoms, whatever they might be, you cannot gauge what their behavior, because it is actually impossible to know, to predict what they're going to do in terms of motion or whatever. Okay, during the Cold War, the United States and Russia were the two great nuclear powers. And it was essentially a relatively stable system because there were two. China didn't really count because it had so few nuclear weapons at that point, and its means of delivery and were truncated. It was de minimis. As with the three-body problem, if you have two planets and you have a little satellite, the satellite doesn't count as a third body because it's too small. Now, China has many, many nuclear weapons. We'll get into how many and how many we don't know that it has, that it may have. And it is now we have a three-body system, which is by nature, mathematically, in terms of historical knowledge or whatever, is unstable because China has come into its own with nuclear weapons and delivery systems. So nobody pays attention to Chinese nukes, and lo and behold, There are all kinds of arms control agreements and verification measures which are in place between Russia and the United States. But it's as if China has no nuclear weapons at all. And by God, they do.
But let's talk about that, Mark, if I may, because I want to just give you an opportunity to respond to the contention that we still hear. It's not just a contention. It is an insistent contention. At that, from the arms control community in the United States, that the Chinese still have only about something between 200 and 300 nuclear weapons. I believe that's still the current estimate. They've had that number for decades now, I think it's fair to say, if you believe our assessments. What is your assessment, Mark Halperin, of the actual inventory of Chinese nuclear weapons at this point?
Of course, I don't know. And here's the other thing. The United States and our intelligence agencies do not know, because China has, and it's hard to comprehend, and people are shocked when they hear it. It has 3,000 miles of underground tunnels, 3,000 miles in which it houses its nuclear infrastructure, both for making nuclear weapons, storing them, for delivery systems,
moving them about,
et cetera, et cetera. 3,000 miles, and we can't see into those tunnels. So they could have as many nuclear weapons as they want. And talk about a breakout. What if they were to break out suddenly and they had 4,000 delivery systems or 10,000 warheads or whatever that might...
Substantially more than we at this point. And Mark, hold that thought, because it's not a Socratic question. It is one that we're going to try to address. What if the Chinese actually do have, squirreled away in those tunnels, thousands more nuclear weapons than we do, or are on the path to doing that? We'll be right back with much more with the great Mark Halperin, the author of numerous books, including most recently Paris in the Present Tense, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to the second installment of our extraordinarily interesting and, I believe, quite important conversation with Mark Halperin, an author and essayist, an analyst of strategic developments without peer, by my money. He is kind enough to give us a full hour of his time today, and I couldn't be more thrilled that we've begun this conversation by getting into a subject that most of us aren't clued up about at all, and we need to be. So, Mark, you were just telling us about what might be the consequence if the Chinese had stolen a march on us after decades of this so-called hide-and-bide strategy, whereby they were concealing in this case, nuclear weapons, but other capabilities as well, only perhaps now, or shortly, to spring them upon us in some fashion. What might be the consequence?
That hide and bite is a good name for it. It is their strategy. It's keep quiet until you have to bring out your weapons. But here's the thing, in terms of numbers, contrary to longstanding positions in regard to American nuclear weapons and arms control in general, I say that numbers matter. The advocates of arms control generally say, well, they don't matter because if China or Russia or anybody has the minimum to destroy enough American cities, to, you know, take out New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, whatever, then that's a sufficient deterrent. But as long as we have the minimum required to inflict unacceptable damage on China, there's no need to worry about bean counting. But that's not true, because we don't define acceptable damage. They do. And all nuclear doctrines are different. All countries are different in terms of what they would accept in terms of damage. And also, you've got to consider that China has, China, like Russia and North Korea, but not us, they have mobile missiles, which are more or less invulnerable. Even submarines are no longer invulnerable, submarine-launched missiles. And certainly fixed silo missiles and bombers are vulnerable. But that the least vulnerable deterrent is a mobile missile, especially if you have 3,000 miles of tunnels. So what it comes down to is that the more numbers you have, not only do you have a psychological advantage, but in addition, you have possibly the ability to contemplate a first strike. Let me put it very simply. If let's say China strikes us and they degrade our deterrent, in other words, they knock out 80% of our missiles and other nuclear means of delivery, then we have a choice. We could destroy their cities. Yes, that's true. But they'd have enough for a second strike to completely turn us into glass. So we're not going to use that retaliatory capacity that we have, because they have this backup. And that's why numbers matter. And that's why it's a terrible mistake to reduce our nuclear deterrent to small numbers, because among other things, it makes it easier to make a first strike because there are fewer targets.
It may even have the effect of inviting one. And Mark, of course, we have gotten to that point in part as a result of unilateral disarmament steps that we have taken, and in part also as a result of arms control agreements that we have done with one of the parties in that three-planet problem that you were talking about earlier, back in the day when there were just really two of us, and continuing.
Yeah, and Frank, people come to my house and we give them dinner and we get into discussions, and they say, well, it's fine because, you know, we have 1,500 warheads and Russia will have 1,500 warheads. So what's the problem? And I say, you could store 2,000 warheads in this house, you see? And if you're a totalitarian regime with tunnels and caves, nobody will know what you store or where you store them. Verification in itself is not a sufficient means to guarantee anything. However, you do want verification and an agreement. In this case, I propose an agreement with China. If there is zero transparency and 100% opacity, because then you get a nose under the tent and you can get an idea of what they have. So, for instance, this was proposed to China, and a senior colonel in the Chinese People's Liberation Army, Zhou Bo, wrote an article saying, quote, "It's absurd to ask China to disarm." He states that the Chinese Ministry of National Defense laughed at Chinese inclusion because, if I may quote him, either the U.S. and Russia would need to bring their nuclear arsenals down to China's level, or China would need to increase the size of its arsenal drastically. Now, why would China not want to reduce American and Russian nuclear weapons while increasing its own? See, they don't want to go into this regime. They don't want to be in an arms control regime. Why wouldn't they if it's to their advantage, as he states? They're hiding something.
Well, they are almost certainly hiding something. And the question, I guess, is, having spent a long time in both government and out of government myself, trying to ensure that arms control agreements were properly conceived and faithfully executed, not just by us, but by both parties, in that case, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, initially, now the U.S. and Russia. I have to say, Mark, I am much less enthusiastic about getting us into any more of these, because I think the history of them has been almost entirely one of unilateral compliance. And I can only imagine, especially with the lengths that the Chinese have gone to conceal and deceive and otherwise be secretive about their programs, that even an arms control treaty that would promise comprehensive on-site verification, and again, I can't conceive of the Chinese agreeing to that, but let's just say for the purpose of discussion that they did, that we would actually have the kind of confidence in their compliance that we would be sort of encouraging people to expect. So just talk us through that point. I get that it's better to have some transparency than none, but that's essentially what we've had in Iran. And I don't think that's worked out so well. Do you?
Well, in a sense it has, because we know that Iran is cheating and it's going to come to a head, as it should. And vis-a-vis China, frankly, I don't expect that they would agree to this. I'm almost certain that they won't, because they are hiding something, and that will do two things. One, it will be one small step in awakening the world to the fact that they're a dangerous and rogue regime, and two, it will motivate us to prepare for that eventuality. Because we have to essentially knock at their door and say, hey, what's going on here? I think it will serve to, at the very minimum, clarify things. If they were to agree to it, then we know about their tunnels. We know what you can tell where tunnels are because of ground-piercing radar, and also the construction and God knows whatever else, what other intelligence we have. We would say, we want to go look in your tunnels. We want to look at your factories, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, I believe that after an initial agreement, whatever it might be, they would cheat, as Russia does, as Russia has done all the time, and then we modify the. But we can withdraw, we can insist, we can do this or that or the other thing, as we have with Russia, but China is so opaque and so beyond any horizon of visibility that we need to at least make the effort, even if it only results in illustrating to the world and to the United States population, to our people and our politics, that China is hiding something and does not want us to look at it.
Here's my concern, and we can debate this endlessly, so I will just leave it with this. My concern, Mark Halperin, is that the effect of arms control treaties throughout their history has been a soporific one. It has induced a false sense of security on the part of the American people. And when the other party has cheated on them, we have seen whatever putative benefits there might have been in terms of transparency or in terms of accountability or in terms of actually controlling their weapons and so on to be greatly exaggerated and, if not, essentially null. This gives rise in turn to the problem that you sort of touched on there a moment ago. What do you do about it then? My former colleague Fred Eclay in the Pentagon wrote a very, very important article back in 1960, as I recall, for the Council on Foreign Relations publication, Foreign Affairs, in which he said, after verification, what? Which made the point that even if you actually caught these guys at cheating and non-compliant behavior, what are you going to do about it? And historically, we haven't done much. I was in the Pentagon under Reagan, where he and Caspar Weinberger at various points really thought seriously about trying to punish the Russians, the Soviet, for cheating. It didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing that you have to keep in mind, which is that now, our nuclear deterrent has decayed so much, and we don't have things such as mobile missiles. Nothing will be done unless there is an impetus to show us that there is a very, very serious challenge ahead. Nothing is being done now. I don't think politically it would be possible to revive our nuclear, at least parity, if not superiority, unless we get a glimpse of what's really out there.
This point is one which, again, we can continue to debate for some time. I think the point you've made, and it was actually Dr. Philip Carber, a former colleague of mine in the Pentagon, who teaches at Georgetown University, who pulled together a team of students, graduate and undergraduate, who actually figured out what was going on with these 3,000 miles of tunnels. It wasn't our highfalutin intelligence system. In fact, they were rather embarrassed by it. But think about this, folks. It's essentially the width of the United States that the Chinese have dug out and hardened underground. We'll be right back with much more with the great Mark Halperin right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Mark Halperin. He is graciously giving us time for an extended conversation with him and the chance to pick his brains about China and strategic developments of great importance to this country is one of the highest pleasures I ever have. So it's a delight to share him with you. Mark, again, thank you for joining us. We've talked at some length now about the issue of the disparities between Chinese capabilities. We sort of touched on a similarly ominous set of strategic force modernization plans. And for that matter, theater and tactical nuclear forces on the part of the Russians, but that's for another day. But just staying with China, Mark, I know you have spent a lot of time thinking about the threats that we're now increasingly facing from the Chinese in the form of naval power projection capabilities, some of them on the seas, some of them under the seas, some of them in the air and that fly through space to attack ships, for example. Give us just a quick net assessment, as you see it, of where we are vis-a-vis the Chinese in terms of the sorts of naval capabilities they have and that we need.
Okay. I want to start off with another story, which is that I was on a panel. I was invited to be on a panel project, actually, at the American Enterprise Institute called the American International Project, which was formed by Senators Lieberman and Kyle. And I went to the first meeting. And during the first meeting, I was sitting opposite Bob Work, who was to be the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And he was talking about the South China Sea. And when it was my turn to speak, I said, this was a number of years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago. I said, well, it's lost. It's gone. And he said, oh, no. Because evidently, I mean, obviously, he knew more about various things classified that I don't know about because I don't have a security classification. He said, no. And I was able to argue, I think, conclusively at that point, and I've been proved right, that the South China Sea is gone in vis-a-vis what America can do. The fact is that, you know, by the way, just the other day, China surpassed the United States Navy in number of major surface combatants. And not that that means they're superior. In the open ocean, there's no question who would win. But in what's called the littorals close to shore and the various island chains going out farther and farther and farther into the Pacific, they maintain to varying degrees actual naval superiority, partly because of several things. One, they have a good naval force with capable ships. Two, their submarine force is, if you concentrate it near their coasts, it's very, very dangerous for surface ships and for even for our submarines, although our submarines are still quite superior. But they also have China as kind of the biggest aircraft carrier in the world, and they have the new bases in the South China Sea, and they have bullied the people, the countries that are contiguous with their 8-dash line claiming the whole China Sea, to the point where those countries are not doing anything in alliance with us, really, to bulk their defenses up or to permit us to establish what I recommended, I don't know, a decade ago or more, which is that we line both sides of the China Sea with anti-shipping missiles protected by, you know, Marines and anti-aircraft, et cetera, so that we make it a gauntlet if any trouble breaks out in the South China Sea. There's nothing like that now. Nothing. We have no access to that area. The distances are tremendous.
Well, arguably, if there's a gauntlet, it's in the Chinese hands.
That's right. As far as I'm concerned, the South China Sea is lost. I think it's pretty clear. And I think it was clear then, years ago, that it would be because we didn't take the right steps. So something else is this, and that is that China controls both ends of the Panama Canal. Panama Canal would be pretty easy to sabotage. Now, if the Panama Canal is blocked, then United States naval forces in the Atlantic, in order to get to the Pacific, and 40% of our naval forces are stationed in the Atlantic theater, in that side of the country. They would have to go either around the Cape of Good Hope or Cape Horn. Some nuclear attack submarines, a couple, and China has a bunch of them, I think at least five, concentrated at those points could actually keep the United States Navy from reinforcing in the Pacific. Because it would, first of all, the weather down there is horrendous. The distances are just immense. And if you have capable submarines, which would be there to torpedo ships passing through, it would be, in other words, they can reduce the size of the effective size of the United States Navy to 60% of the whole thing right off the bat by blocking those places. So then they could block the passages in the island chains, again, with submarines, small motor torpedo boats, etc. Now, even if they didn't do that, they have anti-shipping missiles, and they have them in saturation quantities. So these things could actually overcome the numbers of anti-missile missiles that we have on our ships, and then the ships would be essentially disarmed. So this is extremely dangerous. And here's the one thing that we must be doing. I don't know about the secret projects, and that's good because I don't have a clearance. And if I did have a clearance, I wouldn't say this. So I can actually say it now because I don't have a clearance. If we aren't doing a Manhattan Project worth of research and investment in directed energy weapons, our Navy will be worth virtually nothing in 10 years' time, because the only way to stop those missiles, the only way both economically and feasibly in terms of saturation and numbers, is with directed energy weapons, i.e. proton beam, laser, whatever. And theoretically, they're possible, and we have programs that have developed steps on the way, but we had better get going with that.
Well, I'm sorry to say, as a longtime advocate for missile defense, Mark Halperin, we did even bring it up in the previous conversation, but it's obviously a key factor in restoring deterrence, especially when we've allowed our traditional nuclear capabilities to atrophy. But the story of American investment in missile defense has been checkered at best, and we're now looking at hypersonic capabilities against which seemingly we have no defense at all. This is a very, very alarming state of affairs, and especially so when you expand the lens, as you have, to address our conventional ships that we require to protect our interests in places like the South China Sea. Mark, let me quickly turn to another area in which the Chinese are very actively pursuing military dominion, and that is space. How important is that to all of the other equities you've been talking about here on the ground or at sea or in the air with the United States and other parts of the world?
Well, the one window into it is, by analogy, nuclear doctrines. You know, we've always had a different nuclear doctrine than the Russians. The Russians, for example, the Soviets first, and now the Russians, see nuclear weapons as also a tactical force. In other words, they see them as a kind of artillery, and they're much, much more promiscuous in their doctrine in terms of deployment of nuclear weapons. And when Putin threatens to use nukes here, there, and everywhere, as he does, he's not just kidding. We haven't come to that point, of course. And the Soviets don't want to have a general nuclear exchange. I mean, the Russians and the Soviets didn't want to, but things can escalate. And the reason I bring that up as an example, that is that every country has different nuclear thresholds according to different nuclear doctrines, is that the China has a different space doctrine. For example, they're the ones who, in testing ASAT, anti-satellite weapon, blew apart a satellite into a zillion pieces in space, making it very dangerous for other space vehicles, satellites, orbiting space station, whatever, to stay in orbit because of the collisions. And it's pretty clear that they have a different idea of what would be a war in space, and it would be much more destructive than we might want to admit. Also, we know that they have paid a lot of attention to blinding and deafening us and breaking our communications. And unfortunately, we do not have, we are not as advanced in quantum communications as they are. These are things that cannot be blocked or hacked or diverted. We're behind them in that, as we are in many things. And in the case of a general war, they, again, this is what I mentioned to begin with about cyber, they may be able to win the battles simply by blinding us, because we are so dependent upon all of these electronic and communicative things, which find their, if you break the chain, the space is a chain. That's one link in the chain, a very important one. You break it, then we got nothing.
Yeah. And this is true, of course, not just for our military, but it is also true for our commercial uses of space. And, well, for that matter, those that each of us depend on in our own individual lives, notably things like our cell phones, GPS, and the like. Mark, we're going to have to pause for one last break. When we come back, I want to do sort of a lightning round with you on a couple of other elements of this net assessment of the Chinese threat and what we must be doing about it. I'm very pleased to say that you are one of the founding members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. And I think it's the kind of work that we're discussing here that the committee is actively involved in that is central to trying to get this right, particularly in the course of the upcoming election contest, in which I think the state of our relationship with China and what we must do to ensure our survival should feature prominently. We'll talk about that and much more with Mark Halperin right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this very special, very informative, very troubling conversation with one of the most clear-thinking men I have had the privilege of knowing. His name is Mark Halperin. He is best known, I think, internationally for his highly acclaimed novels and nonfiction works. He is also an essayist of great renown, including as a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, on whose pages he had an important piece today, which we talked about earlier in the program. Mark, I wanted to just quickly talk to you about a couple of other aspects of what we're contending with here in terms of the, well, we call it the present danger of China. Talk us through what the axis, I use that term advisedly, the axis that has been developing in recent years between Russia and China portends for our vital interests.
Well, first of all, I think that it's an alliance of pure convenience and it will not last. But for as long as it does last, it's quite dangerous because there's been a very well-documented supply of advanced weapons and weaponry from Russia to China. It used to be that Russia would sell China you know, a fighter plane or a ship, and then China would try to reverse engineer it and make its own substandard copies. Now Russia sells China its very best stuff, and China then reverse engineers it and makes better types of weapons, because China is actually pulling ahead of Russia, although it does not have, as far as we know, formally, the same huge nuclear capability that Russia has. And also, there's always the temptation for China to want to eat Eastern Russia, Siberia, and the Russian Pacific. And eventually, I think that will come out, and the natural enmity between Russia and China will reemerge, especially in what used to be Soviet Central Asia. But for as long as the axis lasts, that really doubles our problems in the Pacific, potentially, because we'd have to face not only China but Russia and North Korea, which at China's behest could make a lot of problems in South Korea by invading it, if there were, in fact, a war between the United States and China, even a limited naval war. So that's what I think of that axis. It's very, very troubling now. But again, in the long term, I don't think it's going to last.
I wonder about that as well, and whether Vladimir Putin sort of has an après moi le déluge kind of attitude about it, because it doesn't seem as though it can possibly go the distance, needless to say, but it is a problem for us in the short term. Mark, let me ask you about something you sort of alluded to it in your discourse about the Panama Canal a moment ago, but I want to come back to it. One of the other areas in which China has been exhibiting what seems to be the successor to the hide and bide strategy, namely the go for it strategy. Specifically, I'm thinking about the Belt and Road Initiative of Xi Jinping. Remind us what that is and what you make of its ambitions and ultimate application for military purposes.
Well, China wants to expand its communication links and therefore the opportunity for trade to Europe, to the West, and over the seas to South America, and also to the West and somewhat southwest to Africa. And it's making overland links through what used to be, you know, the stands with Soviet Central Asia, and around the at the northern littorals of the Indian Ocean, it has building ports in Ceylon and in Pakistan, etc. It used to be that the West crippled China with the opium trade, and now they send fentanyl to us for our addicts. Once we sold them manufactured goods in exchange for commodities. Now they sell us manufactured goods in exchange for our commodities. Once the Western military ringed the world with bases. Now, as the West retreats, China is installing essentially a carbon copy of those bases and trading ports and trade routes. It's like payback. They're doing it almost an exact imitation of the colonial powers and us, which they always called a colonial power, that they have disparaged throughout their modern history. So that's what the Belt and Road is. I mean, you can't blame them really for doing what the West did, except for the drugs and the threats. What's important to note is that they think that they are the center of the universe, and they intend essentially to become the dominant power of the world. And the terrible danger in that is that, A, the world should not have a dominant power which has no balance whatsoever. We were the sort of like the plurality power, but we were not dominant totally, because although we had a plurality of power, we didn't have a majority of power.
And we didn't really have an imperial ambition either. I think we wanted to be a sort of status quo power, right?
Yeah, we're not the typical empire. In fact, I can make the point we never were an empire. But the thing is that if you have even a country that has a pluralistic power, much less majority power, and it has the political and social system and mores of China, then you're in for a real, real problem, because they are a controlling dictatorship in which
they're exporting the kind of unprecedented controlling technologies that they are now bringing to bear against their own people elsewhere around the world. Mark, which brings me to a last topic, I think, for today, the supply chain problem. We have enabled a degree of engagement. You talked a little bit about the character of trade and how that has evolved over time. We're now buying finished products from China because we've allowed them, basically, to destroy our capacity to manufacture a lot of finished products. Talk, if you would, quickly about what it means in a strategic sense for a country like us not only to be so passive in the face of the imperial ambitions and hegemonic program of China, but actually to be so critically dependent upon it for all kinds of things, including some of which are vital to the safety and health and well-being of the American people. I'm thinking, for example, of medicines, of which the vast majority are now manufactured by China, especially antibiotics, rare earths.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. But let me say that we did it to ourselves, and I'll tell you why. In the late 70s and early 80s, we were far ahead of anybody in the world, way far ahead in terms of science, research, electronics, robotics, automation, capital, and the legal system and commercial system in which those things could be exploited and developed. And we chose instead of automation and robotics, to offshore our manufacturing because it was cheaper. And at the time, although I wasn't writing about that specifically, I may have mentioned it here or there. I didn't make a crusade about it. At the time, I was very upset because I knew that this is not what you do. A country has to be an industrial, technological power. Otherwise, if it gives that up, it becomes like what FDR wanted to make of Germany. It becomes a pastoral society. If we can't manufacture our own machines and everything, really, then we're sunk. There's one thing in terms of comparative advantage. Maybe China could manufacture a certain kind of furniture or a particular kind of machine better than we can. That's comparative advantage? Fine, great. But when it's across the board, because we were simply thinking short term, and didn't want to take advantage of our immense lead in all those things, then that's just, it's unforgivable. And where we are now is a result of that.
And it is a very perilous state of affairs. Our only hope, Mark Helprin, is that our leaders will heed the kinds of warnings that you have been sounding, including most recently today in the Wall Street Journal, and will take your good counsel about what needs to be done about it. We appreciate your visiting with us from time to time to share both the warnings and the recommendations, and we look forward to doing so with you again in the very near future, if you will. I hope we'll have the chance to talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.